Good morning and welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. In recent weeks, this program has dedicated hours to providing you a chance to speak directly with candidates in two important races, the 13th Congressional District race and the 52nd State Senate race. And today's guest is the Republican running for Congress in Illinois' 13th District. Rondi Davis was born in Des Moines, Iowa. His family moved to Taylorville, Illinois when he was seven. He has made that town his home ever since. He is a graduate of Millikan University in Decatur, and while he's never held elective office in the 1990s, he worked for then-Secretary of State George Ryan. In recent years, he's worked for Congressman John Shimkus, including a stint as the Congressman's Projects Director. Mr. Davis became the Republican nominee when Congressman Tim Johnson announced his plans to retire, a decision the longtime congressman made public only after the primary last spring. Republican Party officials selected Davis to run for the newly drawn 13th District, where he faces two other candidates, Democrat David Gill, who appeared on this program last week, and Independent John Hartman, who was on this show last month. The three men are seeking to represent a district that covers a lot of territory and winds its way through east-central Illinois, westward, all the way to areas in the metro east of St. Louis. Among the cities included in the 13th District are Champaign-Urbana, Bloomington-Normal, Decatur, Springfield, the metro east communities of Collinsville and Edwardsville, and of course Taylorville, where Mr. Davis is from. Rondi Davis, welcome to Focus.
Thank you, Craig, very much. Thanks for having me today.
Glad to have you with us. And while I have much that I can ask Mr. Davis, ultimately the purpose of this hour is to give you the chance to question him directly. And I hope you will do so by phone at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again, 333-WILL or 800-222-9455. WILL. We also welcome questions on our Facebook page. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is Will Public Media. As we await some calls and emails, I think it's always instructive for voters to learn a little bit about each candidate's life outside of the political arena, just to sort of get a sense of who you are, where you come from. What brought your family from Des Moines, Iowa, the land of corn and life insurance companies, to Taylorville, Illinois?
Well, you know, I grew up for 7 years of my life in Des Moines, Iowa, so I really didn't see a lot of corn. I saw a lot of activity.
Yeah.
So it was somewhat of a culture shock at age seven, moving from Des Moines, Iowa to Taylorville, a town of 12,000 at the time. But my family, my mom and dad, grew up in a lower middle class neighborhood in Des Moines, Iowa. High school graduate, my dad, and my mom got her GED. My dad started working at the very first McDonald's restaurant in Des Moines, Iowa in 1958, early 59, and worked his way up. Instead of going to work at other factories or other in other professions, he decided he wanted to stay in that business. Worked his way up to manager and regional supervisor. And when he was 34 in 1977, McDonald's offered him an opportunity to own his own franchise. And he was able to pick Taylorville, Illinois, and moved us when I was in second grade to Taylorville. And it's been a great opportunity to stay there, live there, grow up there, and also raise my family there.
What is your first recollection, or what recollections do you have about that move? When you're seven, you're maybe just old enough to have really a sense of this is a significant something that's happening here. My world is changing. What do you remember about it?
Well, I remember hopping in the van and taking the six-hour drive from Des Moines to Taylorville. But I remember getting there and going out to a house that we were going to rent. It was out in a rural area, so I was interested in seeing a pond and any other rural things, being a city kid. I remember getting out, and all of a sudden my mom coming out saying, "Nope, we're not moving in here."
Hmm.
She saw a few bugs.
Okay.
So instead, we went to the other side of town,
yeah,
which is not far, in Taylorville, and we rented a duplex on the west side, which happened to be the same neighborhood that I ended up growing up in. And ironically, if I would have stayed at that first house, I would have been neighbors with my wife.
Really?
Yes.
Next door, physically, or real
well,
close?
There's not really many houses that are close, so
right,
it was close enough to be around on a regular basis. So
yeah.
I always say the bugs that my mom saw saved my marriage, because she never would have married me if we would have been living next to each other.
If she had known you that young.
Exactly. But, you know, I remember that. I remember, you know, getting excited when they said, "Well, this duplex isn't going to be ready, so we're going to stay in a motel." I'm thinking, "Oh, great, swimming pools."
Yeah.
I realized then that, you know, the hotels in Taylorville start with the letter M. And
it's a little bit different.
Yeah, and the closest thing to a swimming pool was a car wash next door.
Yeah.
So I couldn't wait to get into that duplex, meet some new friends. And some of those friends are still lifelong friends. And ironically, the gentleman who I met first came bounding across the yard from a couple streets over, grew up to be one of my good friends, now lives in Des Moines, Iowa.
Oh, no kidding.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. So, as you said, your dad owned a McDonald's franchise and ultimately now owns four franchises.
Yes, he does.
And you worked at McDonald's.
I did, proudly.
What did you do?
Well, first, during the construction, I picked up trash.
Okay.
In 1977. Then I started when I was late junior high years. I started back on the grill. Went through the same training that everyone else did. I did every facet, you know. Cooked, cleaned, scrubbed, mopped, washed dishes, dealt with customers. You know, and it gave me a great appreciation for the hard work that people in the service industry put in on a daily basis. And frankly, I don't think they get enough credit for the hard work that gets put in. You know, we take it for granted when we go to a restaurant that everything's going to be correct, and you don't realize what it takes to put that food in, how early people start in the morning, how late they work at night, and how much they clean to make sure that restaurant is the best, cleanest place it can be to cook their food.
That aside, are there lessons that you can take from the experience of working fast food to politics? Is there anything?
Oh, every day when you said, hello, may I take your order?
you pretty much have to say that a lot now, essentially.
Exactly. I mean,
hello, may I have your vote?
Well, exactly. And we said that a lot when we were touring coffee shops this morning and meeting people with a great response. But you know, every facet, you know, that's why I love to see the fast food industry, the restaurant industry, the hospitality industry as a whole. I think it provides some very basic employment skills to anybody who wants to start out in that opportunity. You know, there are so many people back when I started, so many of my friends wanted to work there, not because they wanted to be around me, but because they knew that was a great opportunity where you had a flexible schedule. You could still participate in the extracurricular activities and learn those important job skills that transcend into their career today. And my job skills transcend into what I'm doing. I'm dealing with a customer on a daily basis, but also dealing with your coworkers on a regular basis, learning, you know, the ins and outs. What are their strengths? What are their weaknesses? And how do you build upon that and train them to do things in the way that's correct? And that's every single workplace in America.
So what drew you to politics, essentially, as a career?
Well, I'll be honest with you. I learned my appreciation for public policy and public service from my mom and dad. You know, we spent a lot of time going back to Iowa to see our relatives when I was younger. And we didn't have iPads or iPods, so I actually had to communicate with my parents during those drives back. And we talked a lot about politics and public policy, and in particular, how decisions made in Washington and Springfield actually affected the way they operated their business, Craig. And that gave me an interest in politics and social studies throughout junior high, grade school, junior high, high school. And when I decided to go to college, we didn't have the internet 20 years ago. So when I looked at the booklet for the college I was going to go to as a freshman, and I looked at the different majors that I could pick, I picked political science, and I did it proudly because I wanted to learn more. And when I graduated from Milliken University 20 years ago in May, I called my dad and I said, Dad, I know I can come back to work for you anytime, but I'm going to try my lot at public service. And I met a guy named John Shimkus a week after I graduated college.
I think we all have a tendency when we think of politics to think of elected officials and don't always so much take into consideration all the folks behind the scenes that allow that elected official to do his or her job. What can you tell us about the roles that you've played both in the Secretary of State's office and for Congressman Shimkus over the years, and what happens behind the scenes in a given political office?
Oh, sure. You know, I'm just a normal guy. You know, I'm proud of the service that I've put in, be it working in our family restaurant growing up or in public service. There are a lot of good people in public service that go in on a daily basis and do a great job and don't get credit for it. I've had the ability to work in the public sector in more of the bureaucracy right out of college at the Illinois Secretary of State's office. And, you know, I've been criticized for that in negative ads. I was an intern, I was a year-long fellow. I can remember 20 years ago sitting at 1313 West Main in Decatur filling out an application to become a Secretary of State fellow, and I got it. I got it. And I went in and worked from September of 92 for the next 3.5, 4 years as a low-level public servant in the Secretary of State's office. I learned great customer service skills. I learned how to ensure that people knew what opportunities they may have to better themselves within that office. I monitored tests, you know, things that you would do just within the bureaucracy that happened day in and day out. People doing a great job. It's the same thing happens here at the U of I, or any other public institution in this city. People going in and doing a good job. I had the opportunity in 1996, 97 to join John Shimkus's congressional staff. I was proud to work right here in Illinois, running his Springfield office, helping countless constituents break through the bureaucratic red tape of Springfield, providing great constituent service, taking the skills I learned growing up working in the restaurant, dealing with people, and turning that into successes and advocating to the federal government on behalf of individuals. And I feel that gives me a very short learning curve. I think I can set up a great constituent service operation that the people of Champaign-Urbana in this district are used to under Congressman Johnson. Or if you go southwest under Congressman Schock and Congressman Schilling and Congressman Shimkus, we won't miss a beat. And that's what I'm excited to do. And I also think my experience working with Mr. Shimkus for the last 16 years has given me an opportunity to help countless constituents break through that bureaucratic red tape, but also help countless communities, you know, in work with the federal government, partner with them. And the things that I don't think any of us mind our tax dollars going for is building roads, bridges, clean drinking water, sewage treatment facilities. That's what government should be doing. And that's what I've been able to play a role in, working in a bipartisan way with so many different local officials in this area. And I want to take those experiences, take them to Washington, hit the ground running, and immediately be a leader upon getting to D.C.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and today we offer you another chance to speak directly with a candidate running for a key office representing citizens of Central Illinois. My guest today is Rodney Davis. He's the Republican candidate running for Congress to represent the Illinois 13th Congressional District, which stretches from here in Champaign-Urbana all the way to the metro east of St. Louis. The district also incorporates the cities of Springfield, Decatur, and Bloomington-Normal, and lots of land in between. Mr. Davis is opposed by Democrat David Gill, who appeared on this program last week, and Independent John Hartman, who was on the show last month. We welcome your questions for Rodney Davis at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or you can email your question to will-talk@illinois.edu. And we have a couple of folks on the line. Let's go first this morning to Wayne in Champaign. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning.
Morning, Wayne.
You know, Mr. Davis, I appreciate your identifying with the regular guy out there. You know, you were a grill man at McDonald's. I was a grill man at Hardee's. We could never keep up with you guys.
But, you could in Taylorville. That Hardee's did a great job there.
I have just recently looked at a website that talks about how we the government cannot balance the budget as it is right now. And I'm concerned as I listen to your commercials about your commitment not to raise taxes. And I can understand your feeling of protecting small business, but we are in serious trouble as a nation with debt. And I feel like maybe while you're running for office, you got to say stuff like that. We're going to need to make some hard choices, a rollback in Medicare, Medicaid, maybe not a huge one, but we're going to have to cut maybe a carrier battle group out of the Navy. How are we going to close the gap we're borrowing to run our government right now without more taxes?
Well, first, Wayne, I think the debate isn't just about revenue. I mean, if you look at the state of Illinois, for example, they told us that let us raise your taxes 67% and it'll be a panacea for everything. Well, what happened? They spent more because they didn't have a long-term vision of what the most important issue was at the time, and that's paying down the debt. In Illinois' case, it's addressing some of the other funding shortfalls. In America right now, we've seen over the last 3.5 years how spending has increased exponentially, and it hasn't helped our economy to grow. We need to change the debate from where is revenue going to be to how do we grow our economy and get more revenue put into the federal government. And the best thing I think we can do, and President Obama has agreed with me on this,
yeah,
we can't raise taxes, Wayne, during a time of economic distress. So what we've got to do is talk to the small business owners, Wayne, and talk to them and find out what they need. I talk to them every day. Winnie Feakin over in Bloomington runs Chuck's Harley Davidson, a great success story. Her husband died when they were just opening their business. She survived selling Harley Davidson T-shirts before everybody in America wanted a Harley Davidson T-shirt as one of the best small businesses. She wants certainty in knowing what her tax bill is going to look like at the end of this year. And then you talk about also health care costs. Go ahead, Wayne.
I spent fairly regular conversations with Congressman Johnson, and on this show, he explained everything we could cut in government. And he said there is no way without a revenue increase we can begin to catch up. It's just not there. Now, he also said two wars that we borrowed for were the biggest costs affecting our government. But right now, you know, U of I is owned $308 million. My cousin works at a prison, a new one, over in Kewaunee. They are 9 months behind in paying their tradesmen. And we can't pay our bills in Illinois. When are we going to say, all right, we got to take a tax increase more than Quinn allowed? I don't know if it was ever a panacea, but that's what we needed. I don't make a lot of money. I'm ready to pay a higher tax to build a better community, not just to keep my bills low. I want to build schools. And I don't know. I do think you can handle a tax increase on certain individuals here in Illinois without damaging small business and those in a very modest income. We need an increase to pay these bills.
All right.
Wayne, you put out a great point, and you prove the point that just raising income taxes 67% in Illinois hasn't addressed the problems of the dollars that organizations like the U of I and others within the state of Illinois are owed money, because you have to change the vision of where you're going to spend money. We have to control spending, put America on a debt repayment plan. And when we do that, then we can talk about closing loopholes. We can talk about ensuring that we are going to broaden that base. And when we do that, we'll be able to provide the certainty to those small business owners like Winnie, who are going to be able to make long-term investments and create jobs that politicians keep talking about. But thanks, Wayne.
Mr. Davis, we have an email from Taylor who asks, what are your feelings on the UC2B project and specifically the idea of a public government entity competing directly with private industry?
Well, my experience in working within the federal government has shown me that there's great examples of public-private partnerships. And what I want to do as a member of Congress is to look at every opportunity we have to ensure that private investment and the environment that we allow to operate here in this country is paramount to getting out of the way in the regulatory branch. I think right now here in this country, we see a lot of over-regulation that has created an environment that unfortunately has killed job creation and possibilities here in this country. I think we need to have somebody who understands that it's okay to get into the weeds legislatively and see where we can assist and still provide that regulatory safety net that all of America needs. And I look forward to doing that to be able to create that environment. And some of the time we need to look at public-private partnerships as a benefit. But I'll look at every single one and every single opportunity just like this one. And we'll come up with a great plan of action.
All right. Our next call is Paul in Champaign County. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. Yeah, I wanted to get to the horse race and the advertising, et cetera. But on this point, you already said you thought the government was important for infrastructure, and telecommunications is just another infrastructure, it seems to me. And if you're for the interstate highway systems being paid for by the government, I don't see how one can make the argument that it's not appropriate for the government to be involved in the internet. So,
well, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that, Paul.
Okay. Well, that's the tone of the question, is that you're supposed to have a knee-jerk response to this, and maybe you lost that Tea Party's vote. But I'm just wondering what's going on with the ads. Tim Johnson has, as far as I know, last I heard, hasn't endorsed you, even though he's out in his daughter's precinct campaigning for you, probably for his own recognition, I guess. But I'll put that aside, and you will probably will too. But he's condemned your ads. He's condemned the DNC's, or the Democratic Congressional Committee's ads, actually. Gill's ads are not the same, it seems to me. But your ads harp on the same misrepresentation of the Medicare cuts that are in the ACA, the Obama plan, which is to go after these high-cost advantage plans, which are shown to be wasteful and overpaying, and it's not a cut to Medicare service at all. Whereas the Ryan budget, which has a similar cut amount, is a cut to service. But your ads, and I think they come directly from your committee, say that Gill wants to cut Medicare. He's not a friend of Medicare. He's for Medicare for all, which is not the same thing. But so that's my rant, and I think you're doing a disservice to the discourse. You're not the first, but I think you should pull those ads.
Well, I appreciate your comments, Paul. You know, let's look back. When I got this nomination, May 19th, a very late time in the election cycle, about 5 minutes after I got the nomination, my opponent and his allies, Nancy Pelosi and the Democrat Campaign Congressional Committee, put out an attack piece on me, hit me, attacked me personally, with the same attacks that have been proven to be intentionally false and misleading in the ads that began at the end of August. If you'll track back to the end of August and look at our first ad, it showed me coaching my JFL football team, my twins, you know, team I've been coaching since they were five, talking about debt, talking about how important it is to put America on a debt repayment plan, because everybody's share, every child on my football team's share, too, of that debt is $50,000. That same day, Nancy Pelosi, David Gill's allies, funded by the same corporate PAC money that he continually talks about not accepting, they begin hitting me with the ads that have been labeled intentionally false and misleading. Unfortunately, you know, I've had to defend myself against those misleading attacks. But let me move on to Mr. Gill's Medicare for All plan. And I have to disagree with your premise that he doesn't want to cut Medicare. You know, Mr. Gill is unabashedly supported for the last 20 years, according to his own statements, his so-called Medicare for All program. It's not Medicare for All. It's H.R. 676. It's a radical single-payer health care system that even Nancy Pelosi says goes too far. This is what David Gill is in favor of. It does a whole host of things to Medicare that do not, that unfortunately do not affect us positively. It creates a whole new bureaucracy. It is nowhere near the current Medicare system. So just labeling it Medicare for All doesn't mean it's Medicare. It creates a new bureaucracy that's going to have, they're going to cost us $1.7 trillion per year. It will require any siting of any clinic, any healthcare facility to go through federal approval. A state bureaucracy will be set up to implement this government-run system. And frankly, I think it will take our ability to choose where and when to seek medical treatment completely away from us and put it in the government's hands. I've talked to countless doctors. I have so many doctors supporting us. Go to our website and take a look at all of them that helped me develop our health care plan. I believe the status quo is unacceptable. But if you look at our health plan, we've got a plan that we've put forth that's going to save money for those who are in the health care delivery system, provide that safety net for those who need it the most, the uninsured, the underinsured, and the underserved, but also put paramount, the doctor-patient relationship and our ability to choose our own medical destiny.
Okay, but the idea of leaving it to individuals to select their own health insurance plan. How does that drive down costs? It would seem, I mean, what we have found in our healthcare system to date is that the larger number of people that are seeking out a collective plan, whether it's through an HMO or whatever the circumstance may be, the better rates they get from those insurance companies. Mm-hmm. If you're just one person trying to get insurance on your own, you don't get the same rates that a large employer with 1,000 employees can get.
Because the status quo right now is unfair. Because the way that public policy has been set forth in Washington doesn't allow insurance to be sold across state lines. All you have to do is look at the Federal Employee Health Benefits Plan. That's a nationwide, worldwide plan. Rates are kept low. The pool of individuals have grown so that people have different options. Why can't we give that to all Americans to be able to make sure that they have the same choice to choose their own medical destiny that I've had in my life and that my wife and I have had when we went through her health problems 13 years ago?
Right. What's the advantage of a company out of state, a health insurance provider out of state, whose doctors are out of state or associate doctors?
You're talking about keeping a system that's within a state. I mean, the Blue Cross Blue Shield federal plan, for example,
right,
has a nationwide group of doctors. Why does that have to stop on state lines? I mean, you can't keep thinking about it,
okay,
that's your philosophy of, well, we're just going to look here in this region. We're going to, but you know what? Let's give all Americans more choices to ensure that the doctor-patient relationship is paramount, because without that, we make government the interceder. And I am a firm believer in medical choices and being able to choose our own doctors. And when we do that, we'll reduce costs and we'll change the status quo and we'll make our healthcare system remain the greatest in the world.
So that's probably a more dramatic shift. Would you say that's a fair word in how the healthcare system operates than the Affordable Care Act itself?
Not at all.
No?
Not at all. No, because it's common sense approach. It's expanding. Most people have employer paid health insurance right now. Why not allow more opportunities for those employers and those employees to be able to go out onto the open market and see companies that are operating on a nationwide basis rather than a state-by-state basis?
Okay, well, I may be confused because I thought you were saying your plan would essentially eliminate employer-based health care.
It's not going to eliminate employer-based health care.
Okay.
I mean, the goal is to have employees be able to choose their own medical destiny and be able to have the opportunity to take that insurance, the health insurance plan, from job to job if they want to.
Which means then it's not the employer providing the health care, it's the individual selecting the health care from whatever options are available to them, right?
That option to take that health care plan would be there, but that does not eliminate the employer's ability to provide that plan, no.
Okay.
I think more options aren't bad.
What would be the advantage to an employer providing health care in a system like that?
Because that's one of the benefits that we have currently. It's one of the benefits that people make on a regular basis.
To draw workers in.
Absolutely.
Basically.
You know, and that's what it's about. The bottom line is we are not going to have efficiency. And I don't believe we certainly are going to have more cost-effective delivery of health care in this country under H.R. 676, a true single-payer government-run system that's going to stop our ability to choose where and when to seek medical treatment.
Let me go back, though, to your concept. If you were elected to Congress, how much would you focus your energy on repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act and seeking to install the kind of system that you propose? How the option that you would have when you get there, if you were elected, is I can either work within the sort of debate that's taking place now and seek to find some sort of compromise within the halls of Congress, or I can really step out and say, okay, no, I want everybody to come over to my idea here and use this system.
Craig, I disagree with your premise that
okay,
my idea is not an acceptable alternative.
Oh,
well,
I'm not saying
right
it's
now.
Not an acceptable
but,
alternative.
But
I'm
you're
suggesting...
setting, no, you're setting the standard, you're setting the stage by saying, well, come, let's talk within the 2,700 pages of Obamacare. Let's talk
right
within the 2,700 pages of the Affordable Care Act.
Set that aside for the moment. What I'm saying is there are a whole lot of Congress people, and each one will walk in with their own ideas.
Absolutely.
And so the question is, do you try and find a framework that fits within all of those ideas, Or do you say, no, my responsibility as an elected official in representing my constituents is to say, I've come up with, this is a plan that should work well in my opinion. And so my job is to influence those other congresspeople to come to my idea.
Well, absolutely. I think that's what every member of Congress is sent to Washington to do, is to lay forth a plan of action. And if elected, then you try to implement that plan of action. And you don't bind yourself by signing pledges that allow Washington power brokers to lord pieces of paper over you. And you go to Washington, you find the good ideas, you take your good ideas, and you find what the best solution is going to be. There are some good things in the Affordable Care Act. There are a few good pages.
What are they?
Pre-existing conditions.
Okay.
I mean, my wife's a cancer survivor. I think pre-existing conditions have to be a must, not just because of my wife, but because it's the right thing to do. It's common sense.
What else?
Keeping people on till the age of 26 on their parents' plan. The key to getting them off their parents' plan is growing our economy so they can get a job.
Right.
Okay? That's what we lose sight of here. The Affordable Care Act hasn't created the jobs that we were promised that it was going to create, except maybe for $881 million that's being spent to hire new IRS agents that are going to actually police the enforcement measures of the tax issues within the Affordable Care Act. And I also believe we have to get rid of lifetime caps. And we do that by expanding the base with our health care plan. And I urge everybody to go take a look at it at electrodney.com. Allowing insurance to be sold across state lines, allowing employers, employees, individuals, sole proprietors to go out onto the open market nationwide and be able to pick a plan that's going to best serve them and their family and do what is paramount. Keep the doctor-patient relationship first.
To get back to the caller's point about advertisements, what does it say to you that the sitting congressman, retiring congressman Tim Johnson, is admonishing both your campaign and the Gill campaign for the way you have advertised or the way that the DCCC and RCCC on your behalf have advertised?
Well, Tim and I have chatted, and Tim, you know, deserves our thanks for 44 years of public service provided the Champaign-Urbana area. And I have the utmost respect for Tim. And Tim's got his opinions. You look at what Tim said, and in many cases, I don't think people are used to, in this area, a truly targeted race. And if you look back to the nomination process, I said from day one that this seat was a target on Nancy Pelosi's pathway to return to power. It's on Pelosi and Boehner's chessboard. And sometimes, you know, candidates feel like pawns on that chessboard. And that's where it's a failure of campaign finance reform laws that have given us this system where we have no control as candidates over what is put out there by these independent expenditure groups. And those are things that I want to address in Washington. I see the impact. I would love to control all the messaging that we have on our campaign, because there are many times, like your previous caller, we get unfairly lumped in to what's being said. If you look at our ad that's going on right now that talks about healthcare policy, you know, healthcare isn't just politics. It's personal for me. And those are the types of ads that we run outside of defending ourselves from the attacks. You know, unfortunately, Mr. Gill has just put out a recent radio ad that he's already insulted civil servants, people who do a great job in public service, with ads previously criticizing my time as a public servant. And now he criticizes people who work in the fast food industry, basically ridiculing them. And I'd urge everybody to take a listen to it, because that's the type of campaigning that I don't like to see either.
Well, okay, but it does come across perhaps as somewhat disingenuous. The question I asked was, what does it say to you that Congressman Johnson is admonishing both of your campaigns? And in the process of your answer, you ultimately attacked your opponent for his ads and didn't really talk about your own at all. It comes across perhaps to some that you're using this as an opportunity to beat up your opponent. And that's exactly at the crux of what I think a lot of people are upset about, is the tenor of the campaign.
Well, the tenor that we can set as candidates, I think if you break through the noise that's out there, that's being the tenor being set by others that we have no control over, I think you'll see a race that's based on issues. And we're talking about the issues. You know, we have said all along, we're going to focus on the issues and the differences between David Gill and me. He has said it right here in Champaign on the radio numerous times. He's going to focus on the issues that separate us. And that's a good, hearty debate and discussion. Unfortunately, the outside groups have thrown so many ads and so many messages in that we all get muddled together. And I hope the voters can see. I hope the voters can muddle through it and see who's going to represent their views, their ideas, and their Midwestern values the most.
Okay. It's another opportunity to ask the candidate on today's Focus. Our guest is Rodney Davis. He's the Republican running for Congress in Illinois' 13th District. He faces Democrat David Gill and Independent John Hartman in next month's election. We welcome your questions at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We are overdue to take a break. This is Focus.
This is Robert Siegel from NPR's afternoon news program, All Things Considered. All Things Considered is more than just headlines. We take the time to explore the why and how of a story, finding context and perspectives on the news that you simply don't hear elsewhere. We take the time to understand why a story is important and why it matters to you. All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon from 4 to 7 on AM 580 and from 5 to 7 on FM 90.9.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and today we offer you another chance to speak directly with a candidate running for a key office representing citizens of Central Illinois. My guest today is Rodney Davis, the Republican candidate running for Congress to represent Illinois' 13th Congressional District, which stretches from here in Champaign-Urbana all the way to the metro east of St. Louis. The district also incorporates the cities of Springfield, Decatur, and Bloomington-Normal, and lots of land in between. Mr. Davis is opposed by Democrat David Gill, who appeared on this program last week, and Independent John Hartman, who was on this show last month. To join our conversation, call 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. That's 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL, or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We'll go next to Inga in Urbana. Good morning.
Hi. I have a question, and I'll ask, and then I hang up. I would like Mr. Davis to tell us how he would vote and what he would do should there be an attempt to reverse Roe versus Wade in Congress.
Okay, she's asking about Roe versus Wade and whether or not there would be. Oh, and it looks like she's just dropped off the line. Why won't we just go here? What is your view on abortion, and whether or not that's something that would be a priority for you if elected to make any effort to overturn Roe versus Wade?
I'm the only pro-life candidate in the race. I am pro-life except for the exclusions of rape, incest, and death of the mother. I am endorsed by the National Federation of Right to Life, but I respect everybody's ability and the viewpoints and the differences that we have on this issue. But these are my values. And I respect everyone else's values, too, on this subject. I don't think you're going to see a push to overturn Roe v. Wade in Congress. But I am pro-life and proudly pro-life.
All right. Let's go next to Belden in Urbana.
Yes. I'd like to make three points. First of all, in terms of forthrightness, you claim that your opponent is accused of not being forthright. When you said that the temporary Illinois tax increase was presented as a panacea, that's not true. Nobody ever presented that as a panacea. The state was in far too much trouble. It could catch up a little bit, but was not presented as a panacea, as you assert. Secondly, you were talking about how you were going to help your constituency and your electoral district. And you talked about the need for bridges and for roads and all of these things that were necessary. Well, where are you going to get that except tax money? You're going to have to tax, and you might as well level with the people that you cannot just go along with tax cuts to deal with the deficit. The third thing deals with health care. You had indicated that you favored choice. Well, the problem is with the health care program that Mr. Ryan is talking about and your presidential candidate, many more people, millions of people, are not going to be covered, and that's not going to be a matter of choice for them. they're just not going to be able to get coverage under your plan. I think that your opponent is quite right to go for the single payer. Most, except for us, most of the industrialized countries have it, and it's the best thing you could possibly have for both small and large business because it takes the burden off of them. Canadian automakers are in a much better situation than U.S. automakers because they don't have to deal with the health care issue. It just makes a lot of sense. And why other countries can have it and we don't have it and we wind up spending much more than they do on health care, it makes no economic sense.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the comments. As you're responding to Belden, I also want to point out an email from Alan who asks quite simply, do you support the Paul Ryan budget?
No, I don't support the Paul Ryan budget. I've never said I supported the Paul Ryan budget. I think when you look at the Ryan budget as a whole, you know, it's a good first start into a discussion on ensuring that we address many of the debt issues in this country and shoring up Social Security and Medicare. That's what we have to do. It's good because it repeals Obamacare, but we have to find an adequate replacement. And, you know, we have to make sure that when we – I want to go back into – I got them listed here. I want to go back into the answers, the taxes.
Absolutely.
In Illinois, the 67% tax increase. You can call it temporary. I'm not running for the state house. When you have a 67% tax increase and you continue to spend – more dollars on new programs rather than making some financial decisions, that's a problem. And I believe there are those that thought that this should be the panacea. So I'll respectfully disagree with Belden on that issue. And I also, my health plan is not Mitt Romney's and not Paul Ryan's. And I'd urge you to go take a look at it. This is the plan that we've put together. We think is a great first start in opening up a debate on where we think healthcare policy and the healthcare delivery system in this country should go in the future. And I believe, you know, we're going to disagree. We'll have to agree to disagree, Veldon, on a government-run single-payer system, H.R. 676, that would end Medicare as we know it, according to others, is not the system that I think is going to work best in this country and allow us to have the medical choices to choose our own medical destiny that every American deserves. I think if you look at my plan, I think it's a great discussion. It's a great plan that I look forward to taking to Washington, throwing on the table and saying, here's my plan, where's yours? Let's fix this problem here in America.
Let's go next to Bob in Urbana. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. I'd have a question about climate change. The scientific consensus about climate change has been strengthening over the last decade. The forecasts, which of course depend on what we do, show that the climate of Illinois will become more like Oklahoma, Texas over this century than what we're used to, and droughts will become more common. I'm just wondering what your plan on dealing with climate change is.
Well, ironically, if you listen to recent reports, they say that global warming has stopped 16 years ago.
That's absolutely wrong.
Yeah, I was just about to make a comment that I would love to see more stats than what's just been reported on a couple stations. But climate change is real. The debate is over whether or not it's man-made or natural, and what can we do about it. But the key is
a Nobel Prize winner here at the University of Illinois. I suggest you call him up.
Okay, great.
My second question is, your mentor, John Simkus, had, based on his personal faith, which I don't have a problem with people of faith, but based on his faith, he believed that we would not be able to cause, you know, serious damage to the Earth system, climate system, and, you know, cause massive floods and things like this. As opposed to what scientists are saying, that we need to take action to avoid raising sea level, seriously damaging the climate. Do you have any kind of I guess I want to know who you trust more, scientists or something more like your mentor?
All right. And I'll ask Bob to give Mr. Davis a chance to respond here. So go ahead.
I'm not John Simkus. You'll have to ask John the questions that you and the points that you've brought up about him. I'm my own person. I'm somebody who believes that climate change is real. The debate is whether or not it's man-made or natural, and how do we ensure that we continue to reduce emissions in this country at levels that we have compared to other nations, and while still not putting America and American economy and American job creation at a disadvantage?
Well, we actually emit quite a bit more than nations in Europe and China. Per capita, we emit probably 4 to 5 times what China does, despite their having overtaken us. So I would reiterate my point that there really is no doubt from scientific perspective whether we're causing it or not. So I guess I should end at that point.
All right. Thanks very much for the call.
Bob, I appreciate your points. And, you know, one of the things that has affected me is I saw how legislation in Washington can affect a local economy. I come from Taylorville, where Kincaid, Illinois, a small town 7 miles outside of Taylorville, our largest employer in our community, Peabody Mine Number 10, closed down. It closed down in the early 90s because of new rules and regulations put forth by the Clean Air Act, where it became more cost-effective to ship coal in from the western United States via train. And I would argue that, you know, we need to count the emissions from the train and the coal being shipped in. It became more cost-effective for the power plant that was across the street from the coal mine to ship that coal in rather than having it dug out from underground, put on a conveyor belt, shipped across the street to burn, all because government said so. I want to take into account cost-benefit analyses and ensure that we continue to reduce emissions in this country like we have, and we do not put American jobs and the American economy at risk while other nations don't even come close to following any global emission standards that people like to talk about, but unfortunately they don't follow.
It seems like this is a good example of something that I imagine a lot of congresspeople have to deal with, which is balancing two basic conceptual good ideas. One is we want to spur economic development, and the other one in this case is we want to reduce emissions, and sometimes they are in conflict. How do you address that as a congressman, as an elected official? How would you address those moments where you might have constituents on either side of that debate, both well-meaning, both with stats on their side? What do you do to say, okay, I understand where you're coming from, but this is the direction I think we should go, and here's why? How do you get to that point?
Well, that's your job. I mean, you're always, every single issue is going to have constituents on both sides. And you go out and you explain the reason why you voted a certain way. And you have to be able to justify every single vote that's cast and tell any individual in this district why you casted your vote that way. But it's no different, really, than any other issue that you deal with in Congress. You've got to find that common ground. And I'm somebody who has worked countless times with Democrats and Republicans to push things forward, to push issues forward. And that's the type of leadership that I think I'm going to bring, is to be able to go in and work with Democrats and Republicans, in, just like Tim Johnson has, in the vein of Ray LaHood in the past, and be able to find that common ground, that compromise that's going to work and make that real substantive change in Washington that's going to affect this nation positively.
We have just a couple of minutes left. I want to get in at least one more call. Iris is in Champaign. Iris, go ahead.
I want to do a follow-up question, the question on Roe v. Wade. Two things. I think I understood you to say that you would support abortion in the case of rape, incest, or death of the mother. Does that mean you do not include health of the mother? And secondly, I would like a very definitive answer on whether, if a bill comes up or there is any kind of movement to work to erase Roe v. Wade, will you vote for it or against it? I would like a real definitive answer on that, please.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Well, life, health of the mother is an exception. Death, yes.
So if the mother's health is at risk, then...
Yeah, that's a family decision that fits okay into those exceptions.
And if a vote were to come before Congress to overturn Roe v. Wade, if there was any effort afoot, you would vote to do so or not to do so?
Well, just like, you're going to have to see the bill. I mean, my philosophy is that I'm pro-life, and I'm proudly pro-life. So I would be in favor of legislation to ensure that abortion is not used as a birth control method.
Okay. Oh, gosh, we're running short on time. Tell us one thing about you that you feel like voters should know about you that they don't.
That I'm a normal guy. I'm somebody that grew up in Taylorville, somebody that has the values of this district at heart. And I want to take those values of this district to Washington, D.C., and truly make a difference. I believe that my experience is going to allow me to hit the ground running and not just be somebody who's going to cast votes the right way, but somebody who's going to go out and work in a bipartisan way to make sure that we make a real difference in this country. Some of the local officials and mayors in this district that are supporting my candidacy are Democrats. They're Democrats not because I walked in and asked them whether or not they were Democrats. I walked in and asked them, how can we work together to help? And they've seen me in action, and they're supporting me because we've worked together to make some real changes in their communities. That's the type of leadership I bring. It's not a Republican leadership. It's not a Democrat leadership. It's a common sense type of leadership that I think Champaign is used to and Champaign-Urbana needs to continue, which is why I hope I can earn your vote on November 6th.
Rodney Davis is the Republican running for Congress seeking to represent Illinois' 13th Congressional District. He faces Democrat David Gill and Independent John Hartman in next month's election. Mr. Davis, thanks for being with us today.
Craig, thank you.
We've now heard from all three 13th District Congressional candidates on this program. I encourage you to listen back to these shows at will.illinois.edu/focus. We will also offer some detailed comparison contrast on our website in the coming days, and I'll share more details about that in the coming days as well, so stay tuned. Remember that all three candidates will also participate in a 13th District Congressional debate on November 1st at 7 p.m. right here at WILL. It's hosted by Illinois Public Media in collaboration with the League of Women Voters of Illinois and WCIA. WILL-TV, WILL-AM 580, and WCIX-TV will broadcast the hour-long debate live with live video streaming on will.illinois.edu, and a number of other public television and commercial television radio stations throughout the state will broadcast the debate as well. Again, that's November 1st at 7 p.m., moderated by WILL's Jim Meadows. Today's show was produced by Travis Stanzel. Kyle Mabry is our technical director. He handled your calls. I'm Craig Cohen.